Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Jules Gill, it's the UBP, It is a beautiful time for video games, all left, right and centre, all sorts of different showcase announcement and ting, so we'll get through as many as we can. I'm Scott Tilford, you are Jules Gill, I've already said that, but I do this every time. Let's get through as many questions as possible. The UBP is where you can submit whatever you'd like us to talk about. It can be video game related, it can be serial related, you'll just have to wait and see how many different questions we get through. First question is from Jack Asbury, who says, did anyone else get a cold shiver down their spine when it was announced that Starfield would have over 1,000 planets to visit? Now, Jules, we haven't really talked about Starfield very much, but what's your thoughts on the old Bethesda in space?
So, as we all know, this is probably going to be another Bethesda games, you know, like massive, like open spaces, lots to explore, lots of granularity and just sort of like mooching about, picking up stuff, filling your space trousers full of as much dirt and grime as possible. I'm very much looking forward to this game. Don't get me wrong, I feel like Bethesda have taken a bit of a swing and a miss with the likes of Fallout 76 and maybe the way that they handled Fallout 4. I do think that they are capable of making a great game, and I hope that Starfield is going to be that game. However, when people are like, oh, it's going to have like 1,000 different locations to explore and 1,000 different planets, if they go and make all of that feel unique, if they take it so that the procedural generated nature of those planets isn't like, oh, look, it's a blue world, oh, here's a green world,
it's a jungle then,
then I feel like it will actually have longevity beyond any sort of rational belief, because at the end of the day, they want you playing this game non-stop.
If they
turn it into like levels though, they might get, they like, so you know, you would go exploring the Mojave and New Vegas, you'd come across a door, you click a door, it opens up the mini dungeon. If planets are mini dungeons, then I still think that, that is a huge amount of content, but I also feel better about it because I personally don't want to traipse around an empty, lifeless world that is procedure generated so it all feels kind of the same, and just like, I feel like that will actually set the game back. That, in my eyes, makes a game feel more constricted because all I see are the gameplay mechanics going, hey, look, I algorithmically decided to put a puddle here.
I've put a cave here. It was like the Mass Effect approach was just sort of like, I think they did initially procedurally generate the original Mass Effect planets and then kind of like lock them down, let's say, as opposed to No Man's Sky generates them on the fly every time or whatever. But I just, this whole thing, they've said that there are, I think, four big metropolis cities across, I guess, or four main sort of hub worlds or whatever. And then you've got 1,000 planets overall, but they haven't said, or they haven't really detailed how they've generated these planets. I don't think that they will be handcrafted. I think maybe there'll be aspects that are handcrafted, but that, like, I know what Asbury means about the cold shiver thing, because even in the reveal I was like, well, we've been here, this was what No Man's Sky tried to do initially. And although that game got there, and I love No Man's Sky, I just think that, I mean, there's no way that they've handcrafted 1,000 planets, even though this game has been in development for like 10 years. I'll just be amazed if it has an authored feel across that much content, or if we even, I mean, the average player, are they going to see 1,000 planets? Like,
That is a very good point as to, is it necessary for 1,000 planets to exist? Like, don't get me wrong, I'm all for getting more bang for your buck, but sometimes, imagine if you were a writer or a designer and you like diligently worked for weeks and weeks of your life on one planet that may never get seen. Like, admittedly, down the line, the sort of like exploration of like all the gamers would make that planet become unearthed and they would share it online for all to see. But at the same time, that's kind of not what the game is about, like, in that sense.
I think they could do with kind of, because they got out there and they said, you know, you're part of some sort of intergalactic police force type thing, going across the galaxy, doing all these different missions and stuff. But like Todd Howard also just said, it's Skyrim in space. And obviously they've added spaceship customization, base building, and waypoint finding and everything else. But I kind of just, I want to know what else they've done that's new. Like, I want to know what makes this not Skyrim in space, essentially. What's the thing that only this game can do? And maybe that's the exploration, but I don't know.
Would it annoy you if it was just Skyrim in space? Because, I mean, it's one of the biggest selling games ever. It's been so well received. People love the fact, like, this is no offense to people, they love the formulaic approach of go here, stab that, pick that up. Like, yes, it's very repetitive, but it's a kind of mindset that once you get into, you can lose thousands of hours of your life.
That's true. I mean, that's the thing. I've played Skyrim. I mean, every version they've put out, I've played. I have it on Switch, I have it on Xbox, I've got the other, I just got on Steam Deck the other day. So it's like, I feel like we've done that. I don't necessarily need a reskin Skyrim again, and I hope it has like a more distinct feel. Although when they showed the conversation animations, I was like, oh, okay, this is that engine again, this is that junk, this is that terrible lip syncing and everything else. And so it's a traditional Bethesda game. Obviously they've removed the voice protagonist for after Fallout 4's whole thing, and they're going back to like a muted protagonist, and so I think it'll have like a vintage feel to it. So I don't know, I'm a bit mixed on it.
But then we already have the Outer Worlds, which managed to show that Skyrim in space, or in this case, New Vegas in space, because it's obviously the dev team behind that, can work incredibly well. If it's that, if it's that sort of quality writing, that sort of character development, that sort of like combat slickness, then I'm very interested. But I know that it will probably, like you say, come with a bit of Bethesda jank. I'm expecting a space giant to launch me on into the moon, if you
to be fair, that maybe this that would work a lot better in Starfield than it did in Elder Scrolls.
Yeah,
kicking
true
you off an entire planet. But we'll have to wait and see. Next question from Jacob Wright, who says, with Resident Evil 4 remake officially announced, are there any parts of the original you reckon they'll cut or rework? I hope they leave the merchant untouched. That's the one thing that has to stay, but they've changed the tone so much that I don't even know if that fits anymore.
If they, because the thing is that it when Village came out, it got the biggest pop when that version of the merchant came out. Everyone was like, yes mate, it's kind of another lovable character time. It's a bit weird. Like, if they get rid of the merchant, I'll be absolutely gutted, because he's endlessly quotable. He's like, even though he's so sinister by the fact that he just arrives and sells you weapons, towards the end of the game, you're like, he is my mate. I would do anything to save this guy.
So yeah, you know, they've changed the time of the day. Like, most of it takes place at night right now. Like, there's obviously new character models and stuff. I think they'll keep him. I just wonder, like, one of the things I loved the most about RE4 was how campy it was. It was how kind of fun it was and overblown and everything. And it kind of did have, like, if you play the original Resident Evil 4 now, the amount of like codec conversations you have kind of give it like a Metal Gear feel, which in itself is a very campy, overblown franchise. And I think that new Capcom is aiming more for like actual horror, like the Resident Evil 2 remake largely plays it quite straight.
Really though, because I feel like the way that Capcom is progressing as a company is very strange. You've got the Resident Evil 2 and 3 remake, which really tried to dial down on the horror elements, maybe 3 delved a bit too close to Resident Evil 6 action sort of thing. But when you look at the new games like 7 and Village, they've gone for a kind of like over the top Fast and Furious vibe, because I have to admit, when I was playing through Village, did not get scared a single time.
No, I
was just like, I was like, oh, this is just a monster, and like a monster in the daylight that I can see, and
I'm transforming
not
again.
Yeah, and they're all like trying to do like weird catchphrases or have memorable moments, and it's just kind of like, mate, stop being a buzzword. Come on, mate.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that that's the thing for the RE4 remake. It feels like they're getting back to RE2. There was a whole thing about the development teams being switched around, and this has been given to the RE2 team. I think they're called M Studio or something, and it seems like that's what they're kind of do. It's like, do what we did with RE2 for RE4, and it's like Resident Evil 2's remake was like immaculate and kind of had a really great atmosphere and everything, and then for me, three was like the big action fest. It was only like two hours long, and then like you said, Village was over the top as much as possible.
To go back to the question of what I think will be cut, I do think, unfortunately, that we're going to lose a few of the moments that are just pure banter and over the top. Like, do you remember the giant mechanical statue that chases you, and like you've got to use to climb up his hands and stuff like that? I feel like that's going to go. I feel like just because
that El Gigante as well.
You reckon that El Gigante is going to go? No,
I don't know. Does he
was he was iconic. He was all over the marketing posters for when that game comes out. If they cut him, I'll be fuming.
Back
if they cut the dog. dog you could save that there comes and helps you with the battle. I will be pissed. I will be pissed, mate.
That game as well. Back in the day when QuickTime events were like, oh my God, I'm controlling the cinematic. This is the next stage of gaming. I wonder if that's the thing that they tweak, because QuickTime events have had their day in the sun and then rotted and wilted. And then it's like, do you include them? Do we have button mashing stuff? I don't know.
Now you say that, but the battle with Krauser, where it was nearly 90% QTE that led into the boss battle, I was thoroughly engaged with that. That was the one of the few times where I thought that QTEs were used really well, because of the fact that I was on edge the entire time. Mm. And obviously any single mistake could see Leon just get completely destroyed. Mm-hmm. But thinking about a modern gaming audience and how Capcom are approaching stuff, I possibly will have to concede that Leon may walk through that walkway, get attacked by Krauser in a cutscene, and then the battle will begin there, maybe move outside with him morphing. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not complaining, because when Capcom put their minds to it, they can do a good boss battle. I haven't seen one in a long time, but they can do a good boss battle every once in a while.
Yeah, I think it's like, I mean, that was the thing, especially as well in terms of like an opening tone that can become something else over time. Like the end of RE2 does go crazy. Like you're fighting the super mutated William Birkin in the very end of that when you're taking him on the train and everything.
Yeah, that's fun.
So, you know, so they can sort of kind of go there. And for me, RE7's very final fight was the weakest part in that whole game, where you're fighting like the super mutated Jack Baker, and he's like all oily and he's got eyes all over him. And I was like, this isn't as well thought out as the rest of it.
I got a big bang of Frank Fontaine from the end of Bioshock then, because it was just so like, oh, you can only injure me in certain times. Oh, you can only do this. And I'm like,
the rest of it is so well done as well, like so well thought out. Yeah, I'm very curious about Resident Evil 4, the remake, because they've called it something else. Like, they called it a reimagining, a reawakening, they called it.
Yeah.
So it's like the original does exist. They acknowledge that. This is just something else.
The one thing that I did think, and obviously this is pure speculation from a RE fan who is deeply in love with Resident Evil 4. Mm-hmm. What if this reawakening, reimagining, whatever we're going to call it, actually takes some of the concept elements for Resident Evil 4 that were demoed way back before? Because remember the Mirror Man?
And the ghost guys, they
appear out of paintings and stuff that they teased in very, very early demos for this game. What if they include those sections back?
Holy cow.
Like, there's a lot of sections of Resident Evil 4 that are iconic, but they could make this game, like, above and beyond the best experience if they reward fans who have supported it from the very early days, who were hyped to see those, like, Mirror Man, Ghost Men, whatever we want to call them, but then were so saddened to see them get cut.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, losing stuff, I personally could lose the mine sections. I don't like mine levels.
Yeah.
Like going on the mine cart all the time and having that sort of on-the-rail sections where you got to go through. There's some weird bits inside the castle as well where, do you remember, it just becomes hell and there's, like, lava and giant, like, gates. It's like, maybe we tone that side down, but we make sure we keep stuff like the regeneradors and the blind Ganados who have their swords for hands,
and they
run around and smash into walls. Those sort of things got to stay. Maybe some of the weird elements go.
Yeah, my memories of Resident Evil 4 had completely blanked to the mine stuff that you just said and the lava stuff. I only think of the good stuff. I wonder if when they're trying to reimagine it, if they start thinking like, well, people aren't going to want these things back anyway, so we can just kind of skip over them. But next question from Willie Araya, who says, this week's UBP just got supernovaed. It's now reborn as a Final Fantasy VII podcast. The Square Enix Final Fantasy VII live stream 25th anniversary thing was last night when we record this, and I thought, because all the rumors were they're just going to announce a remake of Crisis Core, which is the PSP game where you play as Zack Fair. There's a whole thing about Final Fantasy VII story that's a different character, whatever, and one of the rumors was that they would announce that, and I was like, well, it's only 10 minutes long, I bet they come out and they just go, Crisis Core's getting remade, that's really cool, and people like me go, that's amazing, awesome, thank you. But they announced the whole next part of the Final Fantasy VII remake,
yes,
and it's called Rebirth.
Yep.
And there was an in-game thing with Cloud walking with Sephiroth, and like whatever. What did you think of all this stuff before I do a weird fanboy spurt?
I was super, super excited, because I feel like as much as you could throw stones at the Final Fantasy VII remake for changing a lot of what made our childhood moments so iconic with the original game, it doesn't replace it. Like, canonically, yes, it will do, because they are saying that this reimagining is the one that they're going to take going forward. But we will have those memories of what the original game was, what it meant to us, and how it happened. So those two games can exist side by side. Mm-hmm. So, love the expansion with Yuffie as well. And
I
thought it was amazing. And so I am so hyped for the second part. Knowing that it is actually just going to be a trilogy, though, I was a bit like, I don't know how to express my feelings on that, because I was very excited knowing that there will be a definitive end point, because I was worried that it would just be lost to time immemorial. But I am a bit like, oh God, this is a lot of content you're going to have to rush through to get through this in two games now.
Yeah, assumedly this middle game will be like the open world game, essentially, because that's kind of what they've been showing with the Cloud Sephiroth stuff. Because like the original game, like it's all the Midgard stuff, then it's the open world stuff, and then you do a lot of that, and then eventually it closes back down and you do all the sort of final fight stuff. And I wonder if that's how they'll split it, and not to do like too big a spoilers for Final Fantasy VII, but something happens in that game that changes the world state towards the second third anyway. Something in the sky, let's say. And I wonder if that'll be the end of this now middle installment, where they go, oh my God, this is like a cliffhanger for the second, third, or the beginning of the final act, and that's what the final game is.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the things that's interesting is that they said that this could be your first Final Fantasy. It was like, oh, you know, anyone can just jump in on this new one. And I'm like, they won't know what's going on.
The alarm bell started ringing majorly then, because I was like, okay, so you've got a game that, let's face it, is rushing to tell a story now.
A little bit,
and we're already worried about what content it's going to have to concede on in order to get that story out the door. If they are saying that this could be the first game for you to jump back in on, then that means that the first hour or two of this game is going to be absolute bollocks, because it's just going to be like recapping, tutorial heavy, absolute nightmare fuel for people who've already played through this, where they just go, hey, let's reestablish everything that we went over in the first game to make sure that everyone's caught up to speed. And if they do that, I'm going to be like, please just get to the bit where I can actually play the new game.
Well, the thing that breaks my mind, I need to like get my thoughts down on paper, because they've used up so many plot points from the original Final Fantasy VII, including that game's ending at the end of the first third of the remake. So like that's really weird. And then Tetsuya Nomura, who's the creative director of the original, stepped back, and there's a different person directing this next installment, but he's still the creative director of the overall trilogy. So assumedly he had something in mind for all this stuff. But then the trailer that we saw last night was all about Tifa saying, am I an imposter? You remember me from 5 years ago, whatever. And I'm like, you're doing all this weird timey-wimey alternate reality stuff, which kind of plays into the fact, the fan theory, that the original remake from 2019 or whatever is in itself, or 2020, is in itself a sequel to the original game, because Aerith is remembering stuff that she did in the original game. So like, it's just so blown up and ridiculous. And I'm kind of there for it, but I'm also like, I really hope you guys know what you're doing, because like, it's all over the place.
Now, Square Enix love to tell themselves a long, convoluted story full of lots of flash forwards, flashbacks, flash in whoever, apparently. And I worry that with the amount of narrative weight and expectation that's only going to build and build and build with this, that we might see a lot of people pretty angry with this second installment. As you said, obviously he's not the creative helm of this directly, but he will have had input.
Yes.
But we all know what happens with people who just have input. Mm-hmm. It can be ignored.
Well, plus Nomura is Mr. Kingdom Hearts, one of the most notoriously impossible to follow franchises of all time.
I still love the fact that one of the very, like, there's many, many videos out there for Kingdom Hearts where it's like, oh, Kingdom Hearts plot is easy to explain. You're just dumb. Look at the video length, 37 minutes. It's like, oh, is it now? Oh, is it now?
Well, I think that's, part of me kind of wonders if that's what they want Final Fantasy VII to be, because Final Fantasy VII in itself has kind of become this little cottage industry inside Square Enix. Like, they have four Final Fantasy VII games on the go right now.
Yeah, we should talk about that in a minute, actually, because that's a bit bonkers.
It's kind of crazy. And like, I'm like, well, it's one of my favorite games of all time. I loved it, grew up with it, whatever. I'm there for it. But I'm also like, oh my God, guys, like, this is kind of insane. Like, there is Ever Crisis, which is another remake of the original game, plus Crisis Core, but in sort of more chibi-style graphics. And it plays more like the original game, but it's filled with what looks like microtransactions, because there's lots of lots of loot and clothing options and different weapons and different party members that people didn't have at that point in the story in the original. So that's what Ever Crisis is. Then there's the Final Fantasy VII Battle Royale, which is First Soldier.
Do you know what though? I've actually been hearing of people that it's not bad. It's not great in the sense of it's not a revolutionary change in the world. But a lot of people who've been playing it go like, "Yeah, absolutely functional, works fine. Don't have to spend that much money if at all if you want to get through this." So fine.
I'm sure it's fine, and it's, I think it's been out in Japan for a little while now, because they announced the fourth season as part of the live stream. And I was like, "Is there even been a first season?" But I think it's been out for a while. And then they've also got the Crisis Core remake, which is the PSP game, but it's done in the Final Fantasy VII remake engine. And then we have the Final Fantasy VII Remake Part 2.
So this is where my conspiracy theory alarm goes off again, because as you've mentioned before, he's Mr. Kingdom Hearts. Yes. He knows how to tell a story that requires people to play, let's remember, Scott, a lot of additional content outside of the main storyline games. Yep. And I'm thinking, and slightly worrying, that Crisis Core's remake is going to flesh out the story of the remakes that are going alongside it, meaning you'll have to play them as well.
I think that's why Crisis Core is this year, and then the remake is next year, and why Zach was all over the trailer for the remake part two, because that's what blows my mind, because Zach was not a huge part of the original game. That's why he was such a big twist.
Yes, but exactly.
Now he's front-loading everything. He's just all over the marketing. And he was all over the end of the original part one. So I've talked to Josh about it, who's never played the original game, who doesn't know anything about Zach Fair, and he just kind of doesn't know what's coming. And so it's kind of working for him, where he's like really excited about what's going to happen and whatever. But I just, for someone who knows the original text, it's like if you took a book and just shotgunned it and then picked up various pieces, and you sort of go like, well, we kind of make this attached to this and whatever. It breaks me. It absolutely breaks me. And I hope they do it justice. But I guess we'll find out more towards the end of this year. McAllister NYC says, do you feel that the Xbox 12-month roadmap of releases is enough to overcome the lack of high-profile exclusives? Do the day one Game Pass releases mean enough, or do exclusives mean more? And also, we had PG Quip saying, Xbox Showcase hits different with Game Pass. It's not here's some games that might interest you. It's literally here's all the games that you will have if you subscribe to that service.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What do you think of this stuff? Because they have Starfield coming out. They have Redfall that got delayed. They showed some footage of Forza, but they haven't really dipped in and said, this is what's happening with Perfect Dark, or this is what's next from Rare, or whatever. Is the bulk of Game Pass enough?
I think that it's a very different approach that possibly will see them gain a lot of support because telling people exactly like, these are all the games that are coming out and you will be able to play all of them before the end of next year. I was like, okay, that's actually cool. I now have something to look forward to that I have a definitive release date on. I mean, yes, it was sad. I was sad not to see some of the other IPs get some love or see where things are developing. But I actually like the idea of knowing what I've got coming up. I can schedule my time a bit better and start looking forward to, oh, cool, this game is coming out soon. So there we go.
I think it works as well, like PG Quip said, in terms of it makes the showcase hit different, where you kind of, you're watching it, realizing you already quote-unquote own everything they're showing. It's just up to you whether you want to dip in or not. And that is a hell of a value proposition. So I like the way that it's sort of coming together, but I'm curious what spearheads there. Like, why would you buy a Series X, let's say? Because it's like, I want to get it for Game Pass, but you could get it on Series S. You could even get that on Samsung TVs, which they announced all the new models of Samsung TVs are going to let you pair a controller to them and just stream it through there. So
yeah,
it is a weird trade-off. I guess they're so aware of that.
I think it's because they are really looking to double down on their stranglehold of the street of gaming streaming services. Obviously, with PlayStation moving into the market very soon, I think that by capturing audience interest as much as possible, by telling them that these are the games they're going to get on Game Pass to basically add value or perceived value to that product is a very smart thing. Hammering home that image of day one Game Pass, day one Game Pass, day one Game Pass. You're going to walk away thinking, hell, I better get a day one Game Pass. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you've invested in a Xbox console recently, I'd be furious because of the fact that like I'd be like, oh, well, what's going on here? Because as a PC player,
I get
the benefits of your games for a fraction of the price. And no offense, they play better half the time. So it's a case of like, I do feel for the console owners in that sense. But at the same time, it's a very shrewd move from Microsoft to just keep adding value to a library that is already swollen with content.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The thing is, the Game Pass magic did work for me very recently. In fact, last night, where me and you talked about the TMNT Shredder's Revenge.
Oh, yes.
And I was debating buying that. And then I literally just happened to fire up my Xbox last night. And it was just sitting there on Game Pass. And I was like, oh, okay, I just have this now. This is cool. This saves me £20 or whatever it is. And I can just dive into it. And I think that's what they need to do a lot more of. It's sort of, but it has that weird knock-on effect. I was talking to a friend the other day who says they just don't buy games anymore. Because if you wait a couple of weeks, it'll be Game
there.
Pass.
Yeah.
Or it'll at least get a trial or a free weekend or whatever, and it puts them off buying day one. So I think that's an interesting conversation as to why would you even buy day one when you're getting the worst version of a game anyway, which is something that we've always said anyway. Yeah. So it is strange.
So what we're doing now is we're placing reliance upon that one app, that one streaming service, because we think to ourselves, I'm not going to spend money. I'm going to, air quotes, save money by getting it on Game Pass. Now, Microsoft is obviously laughing because at the end of the day, you're still paying dribs and drabs of a fiver, £7, £10, whatever it is a month, whichever plan you're on. Mm-hmm. And it is making that money every single month. You are paying for those games. You are paying for them at just a fraction of the price in installments. And it's the biggest con job in the world to, you don't own those games. You can never trade them in, you can never place things. You stop subscribing, you lose access. Like it's, we all know this stuff. It's very obvious that this is how this system works, but buying in starts meaning that you start defending the idea of buying it, starts meaning that you are Team Xbox, starts pushing forward a new type of console war, which is the stream war, which is who is going to offer the most content and the most perceived value of that library.
I do think it is unbelievable value for money, but I totally agree on the longevity side of it or on the conservationist side of it, where video game history doesn't really have a place. Like its place is whether it's on that service or not.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting thing in regards to new releases, especially new Xbox releases and the amount of games that don't get physical releases because they're tied to digital IP or digital services. So whether or not you have anywhere to access that specific thing is whether or not that game exists in 10 years time or 15 years time. But also, that's like a whole future thing.
You've also got to start looking ahead and thinking, okay, so this is the model that we're going to be tied into for years and years and years to come. What's to stop Microsoft just going, cool, right, you're all on board and now we're hiking the price? You'll still probably pay.
A quid, I think.
And that's the thing. They're going to keep hiking the price. They're going to keep doing that because in the long run, it's going to make them millions just overnight just by just changing one figure on it. So it's like...
Well, that was what Netflix sort of figured out. Yeah, and obviously, they raised it so much that people went, actually, I don't want to stay subscribed to you. There's not enough stuff.
So they've just got to find that sweet spot and they're going to keep pushing until they do.
I think once the likes of Starfield land or they have something that says, this is Xbox exclusive, come play this game, and it turns heads, let's say, in the way that something like a Horizon or a Last of Us does, then they have more weight to go, well, actually, we need to like bump this price up because it is this premium level game, but they're not really there yet. I still think that Game Pass is the best value for money in gaming. It's just that it's a bit of a weird trade-off in terms of what you like Jules said, what you actually own and what you actually have access to, because those things time out every few months anyway. Next question from Darren Barkley, who says, I played Silent Hill 2 around the time it released and I haven't touched it since. I can barely remember any of the actual game, but I remember the feelings and emotions it conjured as if it was yesterday. Do either of you have any games like that?
I bloody love Silent Hill 2. I know that you said that you haven't played it in absolute ages.
Not since it came out, yeah.
What a game, man. Just
well, that's
so
the thing. It's kind of like the way that Barkley said it, where I remember the opening, I remember the nurse that stumbles towards you, I remember walking through the town, and I remember kind of how wonky the combat was, but I remember the final, I remember the two pyramid heads at one point.
Yeah.
So it's fractions of a memory, but I mean, it's 20 years ago now.
I mean, in terms of like lifelong gaming memories, I will always remember being over at my cousin Neil's house and playing Resident Evil 1 for the first time. And that moment when the FMV kicks in and the zombie turns around for the first time is something that will forever be with me. Like, I don't care how scared I am in the future and what new scares the likes of Resident Evil, Hell, and even a new Silent Hill, who knows, down the line might conjure up. Mm-hmm. That moment there will stick with me forever because it was just like I was put into a catatonic state of shock by that one FMB. And nowadays it looks ridiculous, rubbish. But at that point in time,
it for you though. Yeah, it brings it up to speed. For me, it's tons of stuff on the PS1. I remember Ape Escape, thinking the control scheme was phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, I played that when I was way younger. And I remember like coming home on the bus, getting Manhunt, going like, "Oh my god, this is like the most controversial thing available right now." And I begged my mum to go let me buy it, from one of the shopping centers. And then we were coming back on the bus, because we didn't have a car that day or whatever. So I remember things like that, like the original Metal Gear Solid, Final Fantasy VII. Like, me and one of my friends used to get through Final Fantasy VII after school every day. We'd come home, we'd make cheese toasties, and we'd sit down with our little glasses of Coke and cheese toasties and play through.
That's
Final
amazing.
The most childlike video game memory ever. But yeah, so things like that, even though I do now have a working memory of Final Fantasy VII, but that's what it used to be. It used to be the cheese toasty game for a good few years.
Do you know what it is, though? I tie a lot of my video game memories, at least early ones, to friendships and relationships that I had at the time with people. So it's a case of, like, one that is like so dear to my heart is my friend Liam, who I grew up with, went to school with, absolute legend. Big shout out if you listen to this, mate. He and I used to go to school on the Wednesday, and then Wednesday would be our sports days. I have no idea if this is like a common thing, like in
I think Thursday was our sports day, yeah.
Like, you'd have half lessons, and then after lunch, you'd go and do sports, effectively. And
I was one of reverse, which was stupid. You would get all sweaty and then have to try and sit down in maths, just sort of sitting, dripping.
Your school did you dirty there, man. That's horrible. So what we did was, after lunch, our sport of choice in the summer was swimming, because you got like a different choices each time. So we'd go to the local pool, because our school wasn't posh enough to have a swimming pool.
We didn't know. We didn't have that either.
And so we'd go there, swim for a bit, and then the teacher would always just be like there for an hour and then leave. So you'd effectively have a free period to either do training or you could go home. Mm-hmm. We'd always choose to go home because catch the bus back to his, go get get some like snacks or like pop or whatever.
Cheese strings, my friend.
Yeah. And then we'd go and... No, his weird thing was he was like Josh Brown, and he liked having Nesquik. He'd open up those bourbon biscuits, right? Uh-huh. You know, the ones with the chocolate on the inside. Yeah. And he put Nesquik on there and then close it back up again. Chocolate on chocolate, mate. Anyway.
Putting the chicken mayo inside the burger of 1995.
I think he used to dip it into Nutella. He was not a healthy boy, actually, overload of chocolate. Anyway, right. So we'd get the snack, the very unhealthy snack, apparently, and then just go and play Halo 2. Because it was he had Xbox Live and I didn't. So it was like living vicariously through his internet. And he would play that for so long that every single week, without fail, there would be a phone call at his house. His mum would come up to the stairs and be like, "Julian, your mum's phoning you. She's asking you where you are." And I'm like, "Oh, I need to go home. I need to go home."
I did the exact same thing on those early days of Xbox Live, where, like, obviously, when it as a service, we were all sort of feeling it out. Like, okay, well, oh my God, I can talk to people. Where are they? And whatever else. I remember my dad going, like, "You don't know you're not talking to someone who's right down the street who's been scoping you out for days." I'm like, well, true. But also, I don't think they'd be playing Splinter Cell, but I could be wrong. But, like, my whole thing with that was playing Splinter Cell Pandora Tomorrow online for the first time on Xbox Live.
That was the Spies and Mercs. Yes.
Because that game, they don't have it anymore now, but when you used to grab someone in a chokehold as a spy, it opened the mic channel between you
so
and
so you could basically
player.
Whisper something, but like, I've got you now.
Grab them and say some horrible thing and then snap their neck or whatever. And then the same thing with the Mercs, I think, in Chaos Theory, where they could pin you down and they could hold you down so that then the mic channel was open so they could say
amazing.
Something to you and then kill you. So yeah, I have all those memories. I couldn't tell you the vast majority of Pandora Tomorrow, but I remember all the online stuff and all those initial memories and stuff. God, we're old, but it's been a good time. Next question from Isaac Squires, who says, "Shower foods, boiled eggs and a KFC drumstick go well because they can be messy anyways and water won't destroy the delicious flavors. Do you have any suggestions for other foods to eat in the shower?" And then Isaac Squires replied to himself and said, "Update, choc top ice cream goes brilliant in the shower." Now, I don't know if this man was high or drunk or both, but It's a UBP.
Mate, big love to you. That is a combo wombo right
he also
there.
Said, thank you from Australia. It's a massive shout out to Australia. Maybe shower foods are a thing in Australia? I don't know.
I mean, like, shower beers are definitely a thing here in the UK. If you are getting ready and you're thinking, oh man, I've not got enough. My pre-drinking is taking too long.
Crack a can
and let's go.
That's a 7 p.m. thing.
I personally have never eaten in the shower. I don't think so. At least I can't think of a time that I have.
The thing is, I'm making a weird association with like water and food. Like if you swim on a stomach and full stomach, or you've eaten, you feel weird, you feel queasy, like the food moves around because of all the weightlessness. I'm making that association. I don't want food in the shower because it feels like it would make me ill, even though it wouldn't. But
I mean, thing is as well, like I've got like a bit of a dicky tummy from time to time, and like if I'm drinking, then sometimes like beer can exacerbate the situation. I just feel like very bloated, very like quite like sicky. Mm-hmm. So and it all depends on what I've eaten before I have the beer. So I always think to myself, I've got to be careful, got to be fairly like light before I go out. So if I'm there in the shower smashing me eggs and the KFC bucket, I will get there, have one sip of like a Pilsner, and I'll be like, I'm going back home.
Boy.
Gotta go.
The whole thing about trying to have an ice cream in the shower, that's a technique.
It's warm water and a what is going on? That is a messy
steamed ice cream is a thing. But you could lean out of the jet and have a little slurp and then get back under the water again.
Thing is as well, we've got to address the elephant in the room, the very chocolate covered elephant now, apparently, according to this. This lad who is coming from Australia, big bless to you, my friend. You are looking at your food choice, your eating choices as a solution to a problem of that it's not messy. How messy are you when you're eating in the first place? No offense, a boiled egg ain't that messy to begin with.
No.
So unless you're smashing it up your nostril, I do not know what you're doing.
I do love the reality of going, well, I'm gonna make an absolute mess of this. I'm gonna have to go and eat it in the shower just to make sure. I can't possibly do this anywhere else.
What's for dinner? Oh, spaghetti bolognese. I'll pop it under the toilet door and I'll see to it.
I'll have it in the shower. Thanks very much. See you tomorrow.
Do you think that it's just because he probably wears, like, do you remember Andrew WK?
Hell
like,
yeah.
He always used to wear, like, white t-shirt, white jeans, like the thing. Do you think it's just because that's his style and he just wants to keep it, like, Mr. Clean fresh? That's
a little bit of a default stain, just something to sort of give him a bit of character. He's a bit too much. I'm going to throw a little question in here, another food question, from me, but from You Done Messed Up Aaron, who says, Jules, is Scott's recent Cookie Crisp pint of milk drink mad, or is it genius, or dare I say, mad genius? Now, I don't know if you've seen
I've not seen this. Please tell me.
I've changed the world. Now, I went to shout out to a place in the Northeast called Davies, who do, it's like a thick milkshake and they put cereal on top of it. And
oh,
I was
nice.
Like, oh my God, that's a whole thing. I was like, I've been having cereal wrong my entire life. So I took a pint of milk and I put a Cookie Crisp on top of it and that was it. And I was like, this is different. This is better because you can tip the milk a bit more if you just want a little bit of the milk. You can have some dry cereal off the top, or you can munch and glob the whole thing and get all of it in one go.
Okay, so let's
options
break this.
Is what you've got options.
Let's break this down because your revolutionary idea of milk topped with cereal inside a glass.
Just a pint of milk with some cereal on it.
It is just an inferior cereal bowl.
It's not
you have just you've made more steps to eat your breakfast. You're like,
well, you'd rather have a, but no, cereal bars when they started saying, oh, they come with milk, they absolutely do not. There's that weird little crusty bit that they say is milk that's not milk. It's not liquid. It doesn't change over time when I have the cereal. Like in my world, you end with a nice pint of chocolate milk.
But what if you like take it a step further and it was ice cream with cereal on top?
Now
because then by the time you're holding it, it warms up at the bottom and you get like a sludgy goodness that is like a bit thicker, obviously, than just pure milk. And you get, in your case, the Cookie Crisp. But I'm now thinking, right? Let's try and come up with the best cereal milk combo style thing.
Yeah.
Because like I'm a huge fan of Cinnamon Grahams.
Okay.
I think that they are possibly...
I'm with you.
Either or. Mm. But with Cinnamon Grahams, like one of my favorite like alcoholic beverages is Di Serrano and almond milk because
very
it
nice.
Tastes just like... It's just... I don't even know how to describe it. It just tastes like Bakewell tarts. It's delicious.
It's the
almond. If we can get that sort of like... cinnamony, almondy flavor and make a Bakewell tart cereal drink. Mm-hmm. Pitch that to your boys at Davies. Let's get the Scott and Jules, the UBP drink. There we go.
Why not? Your answer to this is that it is mad genius because you've just come up with something that's even better.
I'm involved. I'm invested. I thought that it was a folly, but now I am fully on board.
Try drinking your cereals out of glasses of milk. I'm just saying. There's no going back. Final question from the friend that shows you what not to do, who says, why do some games in a franchise never seem to get that much mention or love? For example, I personally love Zelda Twilight Princess, but it never gets any real acknowledgement. Is it because it's a Wii game, or it just doesn't get close in comparison to the others?
I
think Twilight Princess, people hate that thing because it looks too realistic. It looks too not Zelda.
They jumped quite a lot in terms of graphical styles, didn't they? And in terms of tone as well. They tried to tell a very edgy and dark story for Link.
Do you remember when everyone hated Wind Waker? Oh, Zelda for kids. And I was like, Zelda's always been for kids.
That annoyed me to no end, especially seeing as it was those same people that were like, oh, of course I bought the HD re-release. Didn't need to be a HD re-release. It's cel-shaded, mate.
But that was the whole thing with that game. They were like, oh, yeah, it's just for kids. I'm not playing this. Where's my mature Zelda? And it's like, you mean the second half of Ocarina of Time when he's all grown up, because when you were
five, Majora's Mask is so creepy and mature.
Yeah, and I think for them, they played it when they were kids and they were like, this is the most mature thing I've ever played in the world. And then they looked at Wind Waker, they went, oh my god, it looks like a fairy tale thing, which is what it should be, or could be. And then Nintendo went, oh dear god, we're sorry, here's your mature Zelda. And then they did Twilight Princess, and it was unbelievably boring and horrible color palette and whatever. I know some people really like Twilight Princess. I could never get away with that game. I like the wolf stuff, I think the opening prologue sucks. I like what they're going for, but it never worked for me. Zelda for me should be twee and should be fairy tale and everything else.
It's weird, isn't it, that sometimes the Zelda franchise can take like a weird like dip in, or a different direction, and you'll come up with some of the maddest gameplay elements. Like if somebody sat me down in a boardroom and said, right, we're making a new Zelda game, and I was like, yep, wicked, hands on, I'm investing right now. And they say, yeah, but it's about, you're going to be set on a train and it's just going to be on a train track the entire time. And I'm going to be like, I've lost interest immediately.
You have a little pipe though, little pan pipe.
That's the thing. I've lost interest immediately. But then I actually went and played that game. What's it called? The Phantom Track or something
Phantom
like that?
Tracks, yeah.
Spirit Tracks. I was like, this game is amazing. Yeah. It is so weird that I am involved in it 100%.
Well, but, I mean, they spun off all the Toon Link stuff because it did sell well. It was just this little pocket of the fandom going like, it's not mine. I want, where's the brutal, tough Zelda that I grew up with?
Thing is that like I personally have no connection to Twilight Princess. I didn't play it. It's one of the very few Zelda games that I actually have avoided, just because I looked at it, I looked at the reviews, a lot of people tell me that it wasn't worth my time. Maybe I should give it a go.
If you love a 2.5 hour tutorial, my friend, it is perfect for you. Very little happens in that game for
if I can make it through Akami's 10-hour tutorial, I can make it through that.
It's a traditional choice, let's say. But yes, massive thank you to everybody for sending in their various questions and whatever. This has been The UBP.
Yeah.
You can find us over on Twitter. I'm at /LP89. Mr. Julian Gill, what are you?
You can find me over on Twitter at RetroJ, but the O is a zero.
Be beautiful. This has been the Untitled Banter Podcast, and we'll catch you next week.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.